Radio.
Dante and the Modern Search for Meaning, a talk by Associate Professor John Kinder for the Dawson Society.
But I want to look at this story by Dante as a part of our culture in Western Australia in 2014. So I'm looking at it in a critical and a systematic way, but through the lens of my own lived experience. So you're hearing a personal response to this piece of literature. And the question that I'm going to ask and try to answer tonight is, why bother reading the Divine Comedy today in Western Australia? It was written between 1307 and 1320. It's very long. It's 14,223 lines long in the Italian, and even longer in the translation. Why would you bother reading a longish story about a journey to the afterlife 700 years later? So my talk has one aim, to convince you that it is worthwhile, that reading this story can be, for one thing, hugely enjoyable, but also immensely useful for us Western Australians in the early 21st century. Some of the answers that Dante gives in his story may be different from the answers we would give, but the questions are the same questions. So as I say, it's probably impossible to do justice to the subject, but if you go away from here dissatisfied and thinking, I need to know more, I want to check it out for myself, then I will consider that my job has been well done. Well, a good place to start is with this painting and Elizabeth the web mistress. Is that what she is? Designer. For the Dawson Society, had picked this painting as part of the publicity for the event. We hadn't consulted, just great minds working, thinking alike. You'll see this painting next time you go to Florence, and if you go into the Cathedral of the city, St. Mary of the Flower. If you walk up the central aisle, just before the altar, you stop, turn left, and look at the wall just a bit above eye level, you'll see this painting. It was put there in 1465, in the bicentenary year of Dante's birth. He was born in 1265, died in 1321. What do we see in this painting? Well, in the centre we see Dante holding a copy of the Divine Comedy. And if you can get up close, you'll see it's open at page 1. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, and so on. He's facing to his left, showing his book to his beloved city of Florence, the city that had exiled him and said that if he were ever to return to the city, he and his sons would be put to death. He wrote the whole poem while he was exiled from his beloved city. The skyline of Florence on the right-hand side of the painting is recognisable. The main monuments of the city haven't changed much since the Renaissance. We can see the Duomo, the cathedral with its huge dome, its beautifully patterned marble and the kind of porthole windows down the side, the magical bell tower of Giotto, the big Palazzo Vecchio, the tallest tower, the political centre. On the left-hand side, the Badia, the Benedictine Abbey. That's how it is today, and that's how it was in 1465. Dante's very stylish red cloak is a very good look, but it was also the uniform that he wore as a prior of the city. Florence was a republic governed by a group of 6 priors elected 2 months at a time. It was his political position as prior that led him to be accused of corruption and exiled. On his head sits a laurel wreath, the ancient sign of the master poet. Now, the stance that he's in, standing there, holding a book, one hand out, is a stance that we've seen before. It's familiar to us. We recognise it from older works of art, from before Dante's time. We've seen a person standing facing us holding a book. But the people we've seen in that pose before are saints holding sacred texts. The oldest such images are of Jesus Christ himself. This is the first image of the Pantocrator, Jesus in triumph. He's here holding a book which is closed, and this image was used on the Year of Grace materials a few years ago here in Perth. A similar image from Sicily from the 1100s, here the book that Jesus is holding is open. But saints have long been portrayed in the same way. This is St. Thomas Aquinas holding his Summa Theologica open at page 1. And founders of orders like St. Francis and St. Dominic are shown often holding the rule of the order that they founded. Here's St. Benedict, a statue in the grounds of the monastery at New Norcia, Western Australia, holding his rule book open for all to see. But Dante is not a saint, and his Divine Comedy is not a sacred text. So we can see already that there's something special about the painting and therefore about him. If the people of his city put a painting of him in the most sacred place in the city, the cathedral, as if he were a saint and as if his poem were a sacred text. Dante's right hand is pointing to the other side of the painting, and here we see the subject matter of his poem, of the Divine Comedy. His subject matter is the other world, the world of the afterlife. He's pointing to that other dimension of reality. In the Middle Ages, people thought that the other life was divided into three parts, hell, purgatory, and heaven, and these are the three parts of Dante's Divine Comedy. In the bottom left of the painting, we see hell, or the opening anyway. We see the gate of hell, which is wide and always open. We see a procession of souls weeping and wailing as they make their way through the gate down to their allotted place of punishment. But note that the souls are not being forced down. They are going freely. There are devils and demons and whatnot, and their job is to make sure everyone is suffering just the way they should. But the souls don't need to be forced to go down. They're going down because they know that is where they belong. This is the consequence of the choices they made. More of that later. Higher in the painting, we can see a mountain. This is Mount Purgatory. The souls of those who are saved must climb the mountain before they can take their allotted place in paradise. The entrance is guarded by an angel, and once inside, the souls climb around the terraces of the mountain and purging themselves as they go of all sinful tendencies. When the souls get to the top, they will have returned to the same state that Adam and Eve were in when they were created before their sin. And so at the top of Mount Purgatory, we see Adam and Eve in a Garden of Eden. After Mount Purgatory, the souls of the blessed will fly up to paradise and take their place in the heavens. You can see there the heavens with all the stars revolving around the earth, including the brightest star over this side, which is the sun. Dante is standing in the center of the painting, looking towards his city, showing the city his book, and saying, "Look, read my story. It's about the eternal truths. It's about good and bad. It's about moral choices and their consequences. I've written the story for you, Florentines, so that you can all stop, reflect on what you're doing, change your ways. If you do, you will help to bring peace on earth and you will deserve eternal happiness. If you don't, well, you can read the consequences of that in my book." So let's look at the story now. What's the Divine Comedy actually about, and how does the story go? Well, the first thing to say is it's a ripping good yarn. It's a page-turner. It'll keep you up nights. You'll lose sleep. You won't be able to put it down. It's a story of a journey, and it keeps you wanting to move forward to find out what happens next. And by the way, this comedy is not intended to be funny. Dante never gave it a title, but once in the story itself, he refers to it as a commedia, using a Greek word, or the modern Italian is commedia. There are two reasons why he calls it a commedia or a comedy. First is that in ancient Greek literature, plays and stories were either tragedies or comedies. A tragedy started happy and ended sad. A comedy started sad and ended up happy. Dante starts in hell, ends up in heaven, so it's a comedy. But the second reason why he calls it a comedy, and why we still do, is to do with the language that he uses. Tragedies were considered more noble than comedies, and so they were written very noble, refined, elegant language. They were the highest form of theatre and poetry. Comedies, on the other hand, included a whole mix of different styles and ranges of expression. So in Dante's work, in his comedy, we find the most sublime language used for love poetry or praise of God. For example, the final canto of Paradise, which contains a beautiful prayer to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And I have friends in Italy who recite those lines of Dante as a personal prayer of their own. But we also find rough, harsh, offensive almost language for some pretty gruesome happenings. Every Italian student remembers with relish the last lines of Canto 21 of Inferno, of Hell, where some nasty demons realize that they can't get the better of Dante, so they pull faces and poke their tongues out at Dante as they run away. And their leader turns for a moment, bends over, and farts in Dante's general direction. In between these two extremes of action and language, an astonishing range of subject matter and of language can be found. This is probably why T.S. Eliot said that Dante and Shakespeare between them divide the world. There is no third, he said. It's as if Shakespeare has captured the horizontal dimension of human experience and Dante has captured the vertical one. The word divine was added quite some time after Dante's death. So the story begins then with Dante in the middle of his life. It's 1300. He's 35 years old, halfway through his allotted time span of 80 years plus 10. He's been in some deep crisis. He's been in an emotional, intellectual, spiritual crisis. He's come to his senses in a dark forest. He cannot find the way out. He sees in the distance a mountain, a beautiful mountain bathed in sunlight, and makes towards the mountain, but quickly is stopped by three wild animals that block his path. He's now completely helpless. At this moment, help arrives in the form of a companion. This is the soul of the ancient Roman poet Virgil, who explains to Dante that he can make it to the top of the mountain, but by a different route. And so they set out on their journey. The journey takes Dante through the three realms of hell, purgatory, and heaven. First, Virgil takes Dante through hell. Hell is a huge pit which reaches down into the center of the earth. As Dante goes round the terraces, deeper and deeper into the heart of hell, he sees that there are separate levels for different sins. And along the way, he meets a huge number of souls who are damned for all eternity. A countless number. So many, he says, there were, I would not have believed death had undone so many. Each soul is assigned a place in hell according to the evil they pursued in their life on earth. On the way down, he discovers how hell was formed in the first place. In the beginning, when God created the angels, the brightest of them, the light bearer, Lucifer, rebelled against God. God punished him by casting him out of heaven to the furthest point away from heaven. Now, the earth, as I said, was at the center of medieval cosmology, so Dante imagined heaven as a circle outside the stars, stretching infinitely outward. So the point furthest from the circumference of a circle is its center. So God hurled the devil out of heaven with such force that when he hit the surface of the earth, he bore a huge hole into under the crust of the earth and only stopped when he got wedged in the very center of the planet. This hole is the pit of hell, and in the center is the devil himself. Now, as the devil drove his way into the earth, he pushed an enormous amount of soil ahead of him. That soil all came out the other side of the globe and formed a mountain. This is the mountain of purgatory. Now, the pit of hell has a very wide span at the top, but its center is under the city of Jerusalem, the sacred city of Jerusalem. And so Mount Purgatory, which is at the antipodes of Jerusalem, is somewhere northeast of Fiji, but has never been found yet. So here's a diagram that shows that Jerusalem is there at the top, the pit of hell goes down to the bottom, and there's this passage from the center of the earth through to Mount Purgatory. Dante and Virgil reach the bottom of hell. They see the devil himself. They then do a 180, and they turn on the devil's body, and now they climb up to the southern hemisphere. They were climbing down, they now climb up to the southern hemisphere and come out at the foot of Mount Purgatory, which they then proceed to climb. This part of the journey is like hell in many ways. Purgatory is divided into levels, like hell was. Dante sees large numbers of souls and speaks to many of them. All the souls in purgatory are saved. Their destiny is union with God, but they've got a sentence to pay before they can get there. They go through a period of purification or purgation. They're purified not so much of the sins they committed, but of the sinful tendencies that characterized their lives on earth. At the top of the mountain, the souls enter a kind of Garden of Eden, and there Dante too has to be purged of his own sinful tendencies. At this point, he's free to fly up to heaven. You can see, I hope, that the globe is at the bottom of the picture, and then he flies up into heaven. For this part of the journey, he needs a new guide, and Virgil entrusts him to Beatrice, the lady who blesses. She was a real female person that Dante loved, and who inspired the love poetry that made him famous in Florence. She died young, and he treasured her memory as the inspiration for his love poetry and for the comedy. In many ways, the comedy is a journey of return to Beatrice in paradise. So Beatrice takes Dante, and they fly up to the heavens. Now, heaven is one unified state of being, but Dante's medieval mind imagined it divided into levels, much like hell and purgatory were. And you can see the nine heavens. At each level, Dante sees the souls of people who excelled in particular virtues and are allocated different spaces according to their virtues. He speaks to many of them. Finally, near the very top, Beatrice hands Dante over to a third guide. This is Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, the one credited with composing a number of prayers to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And with this new guide, Dante now ascends to the very heart of the universe and glimpses a vision of God himself outside time and space. At this point, his intelligence is no longer able to cope with all that he is experiencing. He can't find the words to give shape to his thoughts, and the poem stops. The whole journey takes just under a week. Dante starts his journey down to hell on Good Friday, 1300, and continues there through Holy Saturday. He comes out at the base of Mount Purgatory on the morning of Easter Sunday, and after 3 days and nights on the mountain, he rises up to heaven at noon on Easter Wednesday. So that's the story. What's it all about? Well, Dante tells us a number of places that his story is to be read as a kind of allegory. In other words, the story is true, all right. He asks us to believe that he actually went there. He saw the things he described. He actually had the conversations he reports. He meets many souls of real people who lived in Italy around his time. He meets Italians, Europeans from other centuries. They discuss politics, morality, culture, all sorts of things. He meets figures from historical times, people named in the Bible, characters from classical literature. Dante's a big picture person. His conversations are never just about specific events, but about the broader perspective of the ultimate questions. What do all these issues, politics, morality, culture, art, theology, philosophy, what do they have to do with him? How does he make sense of all these different aspects of his own life and of reality itself? How do I? How do you? And the journey has other layers of meaning as well. The journey is Dante's way of explaining his vision of truth, of the truth of things, the truth of reality, the substance of things. So through all the things Dante sees, the persons he meets, the conversations he has, the experiences he undergoes, through all of this, he manages to communicate his view of the meaning of life at the same time as he gives us his views of politics, philosophy, theology, science, music, beauty, and so on. And most importantly, he tells us how he sees that all things hang together. Because I think one of the most striking aspects of Dante's stories and one of the most challenging aspects for us modern people is his united, integrated, holistic vision of reality. Dante lived towards the end of a time, the Middle Ages, when the universe made sense to people, when everything hung together, when people everywhere felt a profound unity in things. European people still looked at the world and thought about things in ways that they had inherited from the ancient civilizations of Rome and particularly Greece. For the ancient Greeks, the basis of all philosophy was not doubt, as we are taught now, but wonder, awe, a sense of wonder in front of the fact that what is. Socrates said, the feeling of wonder is the mark of the philosopher, for all philosophy has its origin in wonder. This sense of wonder lies at the heart of the religious experience of Europeans in the Christian Middle Ages. Because as philosophy and science progressed through the Middle Ages, all the progress that was happening pointed to the fact that at some very deep and real level, things made sense, the world worked. Things could be studied and analyzed and understood because they did make sense, because the universe did have an intelligent structure. In many ways, this Christian conception of the unity of things is the basis of European science. Let's be clear about this. This is not some mystical, utopian, escapist vision to make you feel good about stuff. In many ways, if we think about it, medieval people experienced a lot more of life than we do. I'm not saying it was better or worse back then, just different. Everyone was exposed back then to stuff that we are pretty well protected from these days. Sickness, pain, death were in your eyes and in your ears and in your nose all the time. These experiences then didn't happen in institutions that were out of sight and out of mind, but in your own home or next door. You saw those who suffered and you heard them. You smelt the smells of decay, of sickness, of death. The punishment inflicted on criminals publicly was brutal, direct, and close up. And yet, medieval Europeans experienced life as part of something incommensurably larger than human understanding. It was obvious to them, through all the messiness of human life, that reality made sense. Medieval Europeans maintained a view of the universe as fundamentally rational. This view survives in our own modern languages, in a word that Dante couldn't have known because Italians at that time couldn't understand Greek. But the word was introduced into Italian and then into other languages in the Renaissance. This is the ancient Greek word for order, or pattern, or structure, and it is the word cosmos. So when we talk about the cosmos these days, I think we imagine a black, formless, shapeless, meaningless void going on forever. The word itself means order, pattern, or structure, and it subsequently acquired the meaning of beauty, which is why cosmetics are related to cosmos, because the cosmos in its order is beautiful. Now, this view of things as being united and hanging together was something that medieval Europeans experienced all the time. It wasn't an intellectual idea, it was part of the way you lived life. Time and space were organized according to a unitary Christian view of the universe. The years were counted from the birth of Jesus Christ. They are AD, the years of the Lord. In Florence at the time, the first hour of the day was not midnight, as ours is. We start our clock from midnight. In medieval Florence, it started at the first Ave Maria bell, shortly after sunrise. And so 1 o'clock was 1 hour after the first Angelus bell. In Florence at the time, the first day of each year, the New Year's Day, was the 25th of March, not the 1st of January, because the Feast of the Annunciation is the memory of the first entry of the Christian event into human history. So the hours of the day, the years ticking by, were all based on this view of the universe. Space was organized and represented according to this unitary Christ-based system as well. In medieval maps, this map is a reproduction of one from the 7th century. North, magnetic north, was not at the top of maps. That didn't happen until the Renaissance. Usually, what was put at the top of maps, as you can see here, is the east. You can see the word Oriens, top of the map. The east was at the top of maps, because the east, the place where the sun rises, the sun was always a symbol of the glory of God in Christian iconography. And still today in Perth, Catholic churches are built so that when you walk in and walk up the main aisle, you are facing the rising sun, you're facing east. Christian churches are oriented to the Orient. Sometimes maps would have east at the top, as this one does. And at the center of the map, you would often find Jerusalem. I hope you can read the word there around that big blob in the middle. It says Jerusalem. So this is the world that Dante lives in. He hears the bells. He sees the map. He knows what time it is, what year it is. He's living a world which is structured around this view based on the Christian event. where the Christian event is a manifestation of a unified, intelligent universe. Now, just let me say here, I'm not saying these things in a spirit of nostalgia or a desire for a return to the past. I'm not trying to say that it will be good to try to rebuild a civilization like the one Dante was immersed in, say, medieval Christendom. I'm not sure how that would fit our modern world. I don't see it as a particularly realistic project myself. I draw inspiration here from Pope Benedict XVI, who wrote about this question in many places, including a beautiful essay published around the time he was elected Pope called Europe and Its Discontents. There he says the role of the Church, the Catholic Church, is not to try to rebuild Christendom, a political and religious structure that made sense in other times that might not make sense today. The role of the Church is, says Benedict, to support the existence of creative minorities. In fact, he speaks about the Church itself as a creative minority, helping Europe to reclaim what is best in its heritage and thereby placing itself at the service of all mankind. But I'm getting a little far away from my subject here. We'll come back to Dante. I just wanted to suggest to you that when we read the story of the Divine Comedy, we're introduced into a worldview that is very, very attractive, but no longer holds in the modern world in that form. When we read Dante's integrated, holistic, interconnected vision of reality, we read it inevitably as 21st century persons. Our understanding of the nature of reality is quite different from the medieval one. And reading Dante challenges us in at least two central ways. The first is, I think, that it is more difficult for us today to see the unity of creation, to see the beauty in existence. Modern science tends to focus on the size of things, whether the very, very big or the very, very small, and on the unpredictability of things. And secondly, maybe we modern people understand more of the what and the how of reality, thanks to progress in science. But maybe we've lost something of the understanding of the why, or of what really matters. Perhaps we've lost a sense of wonder or of awe. We modern people, since the Enlightenment, think that the basis of philosophy is doubt, systematic, relentless, endless doubt. Dante lived before then and wasn't plagued by such a handicap. Dante gives us a vision of reality where things are ordered, structured, rationally organized. Let's see some examples up close. In the Christian tradition, the number three is vitally important. It's the number of the Trinity. And Dante's afterlife is structured around the number. Hell, purgatory, heaven. Hell and heaven are the two permanent, eternal states of being. Each of them has nine divisions or layers, and nine, as you know, is three squared. There are nine levels in hell for different sins, and there are nine heavens in paradise. In the end, Dante reaches the ultimate state of being, God himself, in the tenth heaven. Tenth was the number of completion, and ten is nine plus one, three squared plus the number of unity. Purgatory in the middle is the temporary state. It will cease to exist at the end of time and the last judgment. It's a mountain with seven levels. They are the seven deadly sins. And seven was often, for medieval people, the number of humanity. Purgatory shows humanity in its movement between good and evil, between desire and hope. It's not just the afterlife which is structured in mathematically meaningful ways. Dante structures the story with great care to make a kind of analogy or image of this order. So the poem has a structure that mirrors the structure of the afterlife. It's in three parts, obviously. It's long. It's written in As I said, it's 14,000 odd lines long. These are divided into cantos, chapters of around 120 to 150 lines each. The canto consists of the comedy consists of 100 cantos. There is one as an introduction, then 33 cantos in hell, 33 cantos in purgatory, 33 cantos in heaven. Now, 33, as you know, is the number of years that Jesus lived. It's also 3 times 11. 11 is the number of completion plus unity, times 3, the number of the Trinity, gives 33. 3 times 33 is 99, plus 1 equals 100, 10 squared. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. 3 crops up everywhere in the poem. There are 3 beasts that block Dante's path at the beginning. Dante has 3 guides on his journey. Things happen in threes. Dante makes important political statements in Canto 6 of Hell and in Canto 6 of Purgatory and in Canto 6 of Paradise. Each of the 3 parts, Hell, Purgatory, Paradise, ends with the same word, stelle, the stars, and so on. But what is all this number stuff? Is it just a cool game? A cute but ultimately pointless intellectual exercise? Nothing could be further from the truth. Dante structures his story so carefully and so mathematically because that is how the world actually is. 300 years later, another Italian who saw further than the rest of us, Galileo Galilei, said, philosophy, and by that he meant the science of everything, philosophy is not a book of imagination created by man. Philosophy is written in this great book, I mean the universe, which stands continually open before our eyes. It is written in the language of mathematics. So these numbers are Dante's way of communicating to us that things make intelligent sense. That's fine. But what's it got to do with me? This wonderful intellectual system could end up just being that, an intellectual system. It could remain transcendental, beyond me. How does Dante make it immanent? How does he make it personal? What makes this wonderful vision of things relevant to me? Where do I fit in? And when I say I mean me. Because Dante, in the story, is a kind of everyman. The first line of the comedy says, in the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself in a dark wood, for the straight way was lost. This is our life. Dante's journey is our journey. It's my journey. He says, come with me, and I'll show you the truth of things as I have seen it. So what is at the center of everything? What ties everything together? It's love. It's love and freedom. What connects me to reality, to myself, to God, is love. Love and freedom. And you can't have one without the other. There can be no true love, Dante says, without freedom. And there is no true freedom without love. Dante shows us in a dramatic way he shows us that this is the heart of the matter by putting these ideas at the heart of his story. Let me just indulge myself for a second to show how he does this. Now, as I said, there's the prologue, the introduction, then the 3 parts, Hell, Purgatory, Paradise. Each of them has 33 cantos, which makes up to 100. Now, if we leave the prologue out and look at the 99, halfway through the 99, the centre of the 99 is number 50, right? The median number in any series of 99 is 50. There are 49 before it, 49 after, that makes 98. One in the middle is number 50. I hope I'm convincing you. So halfway through the 99 is canto 99. Now, is the 50th canto. Now, the 50th canto in the series of the 99 is in the middle of purgatory somewhere. So the 33 cantos of hell go from 1 to 33. Then the purgatory starts again at 1. So number 50 should be number 17 in purgatory. Yes? So purgatory 17 is the midway point through those 99. And in fact, precisely in canto 17 and then 18 of purgatory, precisely at the central point of the whole poem, Dante stops, has a long conversation with Virgil about love and about freedom. You wonder how he did it without a word processor. Love and freedom. What does Dante say about that? Well, the Christian understanding of ultimate being, God, is of a mysterious community of three persons, the Trinity, bound together in infinite freedom by mutual love. The substance of being is revealed to us in the Trinity as relationship. Being is relationship. All created things, Dante says, are created with a primal, fundamental force of attraction within them. We are attracted towards other creatures. Each created thing is made to be attracted to what is right and appropriate for it. This, in a way, is the simplest manifestation of love. So Dante says, fire, for example, is naturally attracted to high air. And in fact, flames burn upwards. The flame loves the higher air. Human beings are naturally attracted to what satisfies their desires. This attraction is neither good nor bad. It's just a natural tendency in us. Like plants have a tendency to produce green leaves, and bees, he says, naturally make honey. We are naturally attracted to what satisfies our desires. But human beings are unique in having free will. And the word free will occurs in the central line of Canto 18 of Purgatory. Free will is the use of reason to judge the different sources of satisfaction and different objects of desire. That's what makes us human. It's what makes us and what we are responsible for our judgment on desire. Desire and free will, then, are at the heart of the human person. They are the center of Dante's view of reality. Now, desire might be a word that we might sometimes feel a little uncomfortable about using in connection with religious belief and religious experience. But Dante had the good fortune of living before Puritanism and before 19th century Victorian morality. Desire for Dante is attraction, love, the search for complete satisfaction, the search for completeness. And this is the presence of God within us. He says in Canto 17, every person in a confused way becomes aware during their life of some good thing in which their mind may find its peace, and so they desire it and strive to reach it. We are hardwired to desire as human creatures, so that we might discover that in all our experiences of desire and all our experiences of satisfaction, we find good, but we also find there is something missing. Even in our greatest experiences of satisfaction and completeness, we still desire something else which is missing. I think this is how I understand St. Augustine. You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. Dante sees the source and object of all his desires right at the beginning of the story. When he comes to his senses in the dark wood, he sees the mountain bathed in the light of the morning sun. It is beautiful, and he knows that he wants to be there. That's where his true happiness will lie, in union with his God and in union with Beatrice and all those other people who gave him a foretaste of divine love in his earthly life. But Virgil stops Dante and tells him the central truth of human experience. Well, one of the central truths, I mustn't get carried away, one of the central truths of human experience, that the method to discover the meaning of our lives is not through a miracle, but through a journey. The event of Jesus Christ and our encounter with him in the reality of our lives opens us up to life in all its richness, in all its highs and its lows, its glories and its misery, its heavens and its hell. Even we modern people, as we attempt to live the Christian event in our lives, need to remind ourselves that what Jesus Christ offers us is not a miracle, but a journey carrying a cross, moreover. The journey that Virgil takes Dante on, I think, is especially relevant to us in our modern age. Virgil says to Dante, "Are you ready for the real thing? Are you ready to take the road of knowledge? Not a shortcut, not an easy way, not second best, the real thing and the real road of true knowledge." Because Dante's journey is headed for the top of a mountain, but it starts by heading downward, and only then can it move upwards. This, of course, was the experience of Jesus himself. Tradition tells us that between his death and resurrection, Jesus first descended into hell and only then rose to glorious new life. So Dante's journey mirrors that. This is the journey that Virgil leads Dante on, and I think the way I read it, it's the journey that we too must take if we, like Dante, are to reach full knowledge of where our true happiness lies. I must first journey into myself. I must recognize my own need. I must desire the light at the top of the mountain. And I have to realize that I cannot make it alone. Happiness is not something I can give myself. It must reach me from somewhere else, from someone else. And at no stage of his journey is Dante alone. He's always accompanied. Virgil Beatrice St. Bernard. Reminds me of an old priest I remember when I was a student, gave a sermon about the Our Father, and he pointed out to us that in the only prayer that Jesus taught his apostles, the word I, me, my, is missing. It's all collective, it's all us, our. So the Lord's Prayer arises, but not from some wishy-washy, vague, collective group hug. No. It's an individual prayer that rises out of the expression of a shared companionship. This is the Christian method, a friendship guided towards ultimate destiny. The old catechism taught us what is prayer. Prayer is the raising of the heart and mind to God. Dante understands something about this that I think is even more crucial for us people now, in our rather disconnected universe. It's important to know what it is that I'm raising to God. What is my mind? What's in my heart? What actually am I anyway? And if I don't know, then what am I raising to God? Even questions are worth raising, provided I know where they're coming from. An honest examination of myself, of what I am, of what reality is, very quickly takes me to a position of wonder, the position that Dante starts from. And in the spirit of wonder, when I look at myself, the truest and greatest thing I know of myself is that I do not make myself. I am not making myself. I do not give myself being. I am given. I'm given, and therefore I depend. My being, my I, is not something I give myself. It is given to me by another. At the deepest center of my I find the mysterious presence of an other who made me and who makes me in every instant. The most profound thing I can know about myself is I am you who make me. I am you who make me. This is prayer. As one Italian writer has put it, it's to be conscious of oneself to the very center, to the point of meeting another. Prayer is the ultimate awareness of self, an awareness of structural dependence. This, I think, is the reason why the first step that Dante takes on his journey to God is down and in, towards self-awareness. Before anything else, he needs to recover his own awareness of his need, his dependence, his nature as a dependent creature. And only then is Dante able to rise and raise his mind and heart to God. He has to remember who he is and what he is, so that he can move to God with all of himself, confident that he will find mercy and love and perfect freedom. I think that's why the three parts of the poem all end with the word stars, to show me that the stars have to do with me. All that I am and all that I live has to do with the stars. It has to do with the cosmos. Everything I touch seems to turn to dust, seems to die in my hands. Personal experience. But everything I do has to do with the stars. It has to do with my ultimate destiny, which begins now. The end of Dante's poem is another beginning, because when you get to the end of it, and the story basically stops, you pretty soon feel this irresistible urge to go back and start reading the whole thing all over again. Or at least to go back and read certain bits again. Because when you know where things are going, then you know what they mean. When you've read Dante's full vision of things, then you grasp the meaning of the parts of the vision. It's a bit like what T.S. Eliot wrote in the Four Quartets. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Reading this amazing story feels at times like an escape into an amazing, breathtaking world where everything makes sense, it's all beautifully structured, and you feel totally safe because everything is in its place. But it's not an escape. It's a window. It's a frame. It's a dimension of now. We read Dante and we can never look at ourselves again. We can never look at our companions through life, at our daily personal circumstances in the same way ever again. That is the gift of a great work of art.
That was a talk by Associate Professor John Kinder entitled Dante and the Modern Search for Meaning. For more, visit DawsonSociety.org.au or cradio.org.au.